Hello everyone and welcome to Risky Business number 217. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security, makers of fine information security software, and you can check them out at tenable.com. And in this week's feature interview, we're going to have a chat to the man himself, Patrick Webster, also known as OzHack. He's the guy who found himself in a bit of trouble with First State Superannuation over the last couple of weeks. This is a story we've covered on the show for the last two episodes. But if you haven't heard about it, long story short, Pat saw a bug in First State Superannuation's statement system. He probed it, he let them know 12 hours later, and then wound up with the police on his door and a commercial law firm threatening to sue him on behalf of First State. Well, since then, it's turned into a pretty big deal here in Australia. The police and the civil action against Webster have both been dropped, and First State Super has wound up in a bunch of trouble. We'll hear all about that in a moment, and also, of course, chat to Pat about his experience through the whole saga. In this week's sponsor interview, we're chatting with Tenable Network Security's Chief Executive, Ron Gula, about a recent edict from the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States that advises companies on what sort of cyber risks and incidents they should be disclosing in their quarterly filings. Ron has an interesting take on the edict. Initially, I kind of disagreed with him on it, but he did win me over, so I hope you'll stick around for that. But before all of that, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, a fascinating story that broke about a week ago. Apparently, a bunch of attackers unknown origin were able to gain entry into some sort of NASDAQ system that allowed them to spy on all sorts of company directors. It seems a pretty big story.
Yeah, so it's been we've had a couple of stories, I guess, about the NASDAQ and associated infrastructure getting owned. But this one came out that they appear to have compromised some kind of web application that was used for document sharing between NASDAQ-listed companies and the exchange and stuff, and that people who had broken into this were actually eavesdropping on the communications or eavesdropping on these documents that are being submitted through the system and had been doing so for some time. And, you know, that definitely could, you know, provide some people with advantage in the marketplace and, you know, real financial incentives to do that. And it's kind of part of the larger discussion we've seen of the NASDAQ getting owned. It's interesting to see this particular detail come out because of when we originally covered the story, right? They were had the usual party line that, you know, nothing got owned and nothing really happened. And
everything's fine. Please move on.
Everything's fine. There was no important data. Yeah, like it was just but a flesh wound.
But yeah, apparently this software, Director's Desk, which allowed some sort of communication and document sharing between directors of NASDAQ-listed companies and the exchange, got pwnsorized.
It's kind of funny, too, that the NASDAQ boss has been coming out saying that they spend something like $1 billion on security alone, which...
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
Yeah, I'm calling horse shit on that one, buddy.
Yeah, the NASDAQ's chief executive, Robert Greifeld, told Reuters that, they spend $1 billion a year on security alone, which is bullshit.
Exactly.
Anyway, so look, very interesting story. I mean, you would think, though, that perhaps these directors of these NASDAQ-listed companies might have actually wanted to have a bit of a look at that application themselves, but no, apparently not.
Nope. And, the fact that the NSA are now involved really does suggest that it is a bigger issue than, was previously presented.
Moving on to another story. This one, this one's been written up pretty much everywhere. Some dudes have released a new tool that allows you to very easily DOS SSL'd sites.
Yeah, so the THC, the Hackers Collective, which is kind of old school German hacker crew.
The Hacker's Choice, I believe.
The Hacker's Choice, yes. Old school German hacker crew released this tool, which is basically an algorithmic kind of complexity denial of service against SSL implementations. And, I don't think anyone is particularly surprised. I mean, the guts, of course, really is weaponizing and turning it into something that's, .slash usable by kiddies. And I'm sure we will see it being used to drop some interesting high profile things. And of course, it dovetails nicely with all the sites that we've been praising lately for rolling out default SSL all over the place. And and this is the reward that they get.
Yeah, I may have heard about this particular technique in the past. Difficult one to fix, from what I understand.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I think this kind of slightly more quantitative denial of service attack development, I think, is something we're going to see more of. People are actually sitting down and doing the numbers, when you're fuzzing something or when you're sending malformed shit to things, to try and find the things that really do cost the most in terms of remote CPU resource, and then weaponizing that. And we haven't really seen a lot of that kind of statistical work put into weaponizing a denial of service, and that is something people are doing.
Well, there was a TCP stress or whatever that was out recently. That was the
the SOC stress tool.
SOC stress, that's the one. Yeah. So I mean, it's always going to be a problem, isn't it? And apparently, vendors have known about this problem. This story notes that vendors have known about this problem since about 2003, but they haven't really done anything to fix it. Probably because it's very hard.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a feature more than a bug, isn't it?
Now, here's a headline that we all love to see every now and then, which is hackers targeted US government satellites. Apparently, a bunch of US satellites did actually get owned.
Yeah, it's an interesting story, isn't it? Everyone likes a bit of the old satellite hacking. It's something I'm sure a lot of hackers would like to do. But so apparently some dudes owned the Svalbard satellite station in Norway, which apparently is the ground station for a bunch of satellites. In this particular case, Landsat 7, apparently, is an Earth observation satellite run by NASA, experienced, 12 minutes of interference between October 2007 and July 2008. And another satellite was messed with as well. And apparently, they said that the attackers in question had achieved everything necessary to have complete control of the satellite, but did not actually exercise this into a certain control. But the fact that they were in a position to do so, certainly is something people should be concerned about, I guess. And I'm sure, the guys at the ground station in Norway are feeling a bit silly right about now. But interesting stuff. And obviously, there's a lot more spooky satellites floating around that would be interesting targets as well. And I guess the people who did this, maybe they've gone on to bigger and better things.
Yeah, well, according to this report, the satellite station in question routinely relied on the internet for data access and file transfers. Hooray!
Like everybody else.
Pretty much. So as it turns out, you can own satellites that way. But you sort of wonder if this was some sort of, secret squirrel geopolitical maneuvering and message sending, or if it was a beardy guy like you.
Well, I'd like to own some satellites. That sounds like fun. either sounds plausible.
Talk about the mother of all data leaks. Apparently, a rogue Israeli government contractor walked out the door of the equivalent of their birth, deaths, and marriages registry with details on 9 million Israelis, which is now handily available as a torrent.
Yeah, so this is every single citizen in Israel?
Yeah.
According to the article, this is not cool. And, these guys have been picked up obviously are not going to get a whole bunch of leniency out of the court system in Israel, I imagine. But, this is a hell of a data leak. And, apparently the guy was gave it to some friends. I read another story somewhere which I think said that there was money involved as well. But
he was shared around the place. To sort of assist in a whole bunch of fraudulent stuff that he was involved in. Apparently in the Hasidic Jewish criminal underworld, which is a real thing. I did not know this, but there you go.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting too, because in Israel, the government is considering rolling out this massive nationwide biometrics database. And this leak has been seen as a real black mark against this database getting up, because they're saying, well, look, if all of this data can leak, then why should we trust you with anything further like biometric info?
Yeah, and I was very, very glad to see that this write-up from ZDNet actually did mention that, and that is something that people have latched onto in the slightly more mainstream than Risky Business press, because it's one of the core problems of biometric, right, is that once your creds get leaked or the hash of your fingerprint or whatever, you can't change your password when it's your fingerprint or your retinal scan or whatever.
You can, but it's painful.
Yeah, but no, this is a very, very important issue when people are considering, especially nationwide biometrics. So I'm really glad that that was in the article, and it's a debate that I'm I think we should all follow in Israel and see actually what comes out of it.
Now, in some excellent reporting from dedicated InfoSec reporter Brian Krebs of KrebsOnSecurity.com, We have seen a very interesting report that basically identifies or claims to identify other organisations that were hit by the same attackers who attacked RSA. And in this blog post, Brian Krebs lists around 760 organisations that that apparently were detected communicating with the same command and control system that the RSA stuff was.
Yeah, this is a very good piece. And of course, there's a lot of conjecture around it still in terms of identifying exactly who got owned. But as we've seen recently, tracking command and control connections really is a very, very useful tool for identifying who's being owned by what. And of course, when we originally discussed the RSA intrusion and then the subsequent alleged intrusion into Lockheed Martin using data stolen from RSA, really the question was who else was getting owned like this? Because, if it's happening to RSA and happened to Lockheed Martin, we have to assume that the same people are doing it elsewhere. And this, I was very pleased to see this follow-up from Brian. And it lists a real laundry, it lists a laundry list. That's great, Adam. Good. Good choice of words there. There's a real big list of interesting people. Northrop Grumman, Motorola, Novell, PricewaterhouseCooper, lots of people, VMware, which I guess, part of EMC. Mm. Lots and lots of interesting things. But of course, there's also plenty of, ISPs and people on the edge of the network. Like I think even a couple of ISPs in New Zealand are on the list.
Yeah, there's heaps of Australians as well. There's also, organisations that run gateways like CSC, things like that. So we have seen a large number of connectivity providers. So the assumption there has got to be that it's their customers that have been owned, not necessarily the ISPs themselves. But certainly some Australian government targets and all sorts of stuff. One funny one that I pulled out and published in a blog post was Team Seemaru, right? Which you've got to assume is them actually messing with the CNC. So it's like I really doubt that they were. I would think it unlikely that they were owned by this particular malware. So you're kind of looking at the connect backs. Do you know what I mean? Someone's obviously observing these drop points or whatever, and then doing some sort of lookup on the IP, but I don't know. It doesn't definitively tell you whether or not they were owned, does it?
No. I mean, the nature of the list certainly suggests that it is the result of sniffing callback command and control traffic and then just looking at the network allocation. So not a particularly sophisticated or in-depth analysis. But on the other hand, right, you do have to assume that connections coming out of Seagate, for example, Seagate don't on-cell connectivity, I am sure. Those are probably quite a bit more concerning. It's interesting that Brian hasn't really said where he got this data from. And traditionally, Brian is pretty good at that attribution of his sources and things.
He kind of hints at it. He says that it's the list is doing the rounds among congressional staffers in Washington.
Yeah. So, and there was some criticism, I guess, in the comments on his blog about, where he got it from and, obviously the fact that he wasn't, clearly upfront disclosing where it came from. But yeah, as you say, there were hints and things, and I'm sure as the story progresses, we will actually, eventually he will tell us where and how and provide some more information, and I will be certainly following to see what's going on.
Yeah, quite often this sort of information is leaked to the press because it's a good way of letting people know, perhaps on that list, who might not have otherwise necessarily been aware. So, anyway, interesting piece, well worth going and having a look to see if your name is on the list. Now, a few weeks ago, Adam, we covered this story of Microsoft dismantling one of these Czech Republic-based botnets. They claim to have named a guy, Dominique Alexander Piatti, and his domain name company, which was Dot Free Group, as the alleged ringleaders behind this botnet. Apparently, Microsoft has now dropped its action against this guy and said, so we said it was you, but it kind of isn't. And if you could just help us dismantle this botnet, because they're using your DNS infrastructure and your free subdomain infrastructure to actually do this stuff, he's like a free DNS provider, that would be really good. Kate, thanks, bye.
Yeah, so we've seen Microsoft going after a number of botnets using a combination of legal and technical measures, and it has been quite effective. I mean, they took out Waladac and Rostock, and this one's the Kelios botnet, and it sounds like this has been relatively successful, and this guy has voluntarily handed over a bunch of the domains that are being used or subdomains that are being used by the Kelios botnet, and that will presumably allow Microsoft to intercept more of the traffic and maybe make some progress towards actually finding out who was responsible, as it seems this guy was just involved kind of accidentally rather than deliberately. I think this it really is an endorsement for Microsoft on the success of this particular strategy against large-scale botnets, and good on them for spending the resource to do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of not good that they named the wrong guy, though, you know?
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's, you know, the nature of attribution on the internet, right? It's all China, China. Oh, hang on a sec. Did we say that? We meant Russia. Actually, no, it's a guy from Bulgaria.
It's Liechtenstein.
Yeah. Spasid and Amjad.
Now staying with Microsoft, and very similar to Sesame Street, actually, their YouTube channel got pwned.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the lesson here is that, you know, Google's going to have to sort out some two-factor auth for some of these high-profile YouTube channels. Otherwise, it's just going to look bad for them and continue to look bad.
It's going to wind up looking like Twitter.
Well, exactly, yeah. And, I mean, Google have been rolling out, you know, two-factor auth into other of their properties, and they, you know, they need to roll that into YouTube too.
Yep. Now here's a good news story. Android version 4.0 Ice Cream Sandwich. Fantastic name for software, I guess. It's getting ASLR.
Yeah, there's a bunch of new features obviously going into Ice Cream Sandwich, and ASLR from a security perspective is definitely one of the interesting ones. And we've given Google a bunch of stick in the past about the lack of you know, basic technical security mechanisms like ASLR on the platform. So it's good to see that that has actually turned up, and in combination with some of the other things they've added, improvements to the crypto APIs, the, you know, for certificate storage and stuff, and some per application permissions. It looks like a pretty good set of improvements for 4.0, which is, you know, is great, and certainly no real criticism of Google for that. But on the other hand, like, it really doesn't address the core problem of Android security for the, you know, 40% market share that's already out there, you know, of people who you know, won't or can't upgrade off, you know, in some cases, you know, as old as Android 1.6, 1.7 on some phones. So, you know, it's good. And, you know, in 2 years, 3 years, 4 years from now, you know, when the entire, you know, fielded set of Android phones are running 4.0, then it will be a great thing.
Well, I mean, the other question is whether or not they've made any change to the patching model, because that's also a pretty significant issue with Android. So whether or not they're allowing, you know, components of the OS to be updated on the fly, or whether they're still relying on cooperation between, you know, Google, the handset manufacturers, and the telcos to actually get updates to handsets. So
yeah,
we'll just have to see when it hits, like, how good it is.
Yeah.
If people are still finding O-Day left, right, and center in it. Now, Anonymous has finally done something useful and doxed around 1,500 people who are part of a private kiddie porn sharing file sharing network.
So yeah, they've apparently owned the shared hosting platform that people were running this particular kiddie porn distro site on, and they said, what, something like 100 gig of kiddie porn content, and they doxed all the people involved, which I guess, you know, is a good thing. And we all agree that kiddie porn is bad, and people who are doing that probably deserve to get doxed. But, you know, the real question is, you know, if they did find information that was, you know, that significant in terms of identifying people involved, you know, really it would be better used by law enforcement rather than giving these guys a, you know, a chance to run for cover.
You're right. I mean, Nigel Fair, who is a ex-Aussie Fed, has come out and said, yeah, look, I mean, if there was any sort of police investigation going on here, it would have interfered. So, you know, don't be vigilante dicks, basically. If you're going to get info, uncover stuff like this, take it to the authorities.
Yeah, and it would be, you know, useful if there was some kind of, you know, mechanism by which you could disclose this information to the cops, you know, without actually getting yourself in trouble in the process. Mm. Like, it's such a, you know, as we've seen recently, like, disclosing even a simple basic issue and something that probably you did have the right to own is very complicated, let alone, you know, something like this.
And Patrick Webster is this week's feature guest. That's coming up after the news. real quick, there's been some interesting flash bug that's been closed up. It's some sort of clickjacking something-something server-side. Something, what?
Yeah, so basically there was a mechanism by which you could clickjack the Flash settings panel, which is itself a Flash applet. So the idea is that you would overlay transparent frame, overlay an opaque frame on top of the Flash settings applet and convince people to click through it, or, yeah, you know, standard kind of clickjacking sort of thing. And from there you could manipulate the Flash settings, which includes allowing people to access your webcam, which is a bad thing, and that's been played up in the media coverage of this. And obviously it is a bad thing if people are peering at your webcam, you know, taking nudie pics of you. But the interesting thing about this from a fixing perspective is that Adobe can actually fix this in the settings panel, which is a Flash app hosted on their infrastructure. So they fix it in one place and everybody's patched against this particular exploit, which I guess is a nice change from you know, every other Flash bug ever.
Pretty much, yeah. But it was a clever little attack, you'd have to agree.
Yeah, I agree. It is a, you know, good kind of lateral thinking there, and good use of clickjacking.
Now, in news here in Australia, the DSD, which is, I guess, our equivalent of the National Security Agency, they're our, you know, geek spooks, I guess you'd call them, has actually won the US National Cybersecurity Innovation Award from the SANS Institute for its basic security controls. Apparently, you know, the way the DSD rolls is apparently extremely efficient and quite effective. And what they've basically won the award for is for effective implementation of four controls. That's application updating and patching, OS patching, whitelisting, and really strict account control. And they've got a massive attaboy out of, you know, 50 nominated organizations and 14 shortlisted. So way to go, DSD.
Yeah. And
and know, Steve McLeod and Chris Brooks, apparently, of the DSD for their work in it. Go, guys.
And I have had a look at the list, and I think it is a very good, very sensible, very pragmatic, and very cheap, importantly, list. And, you know, it is cool, and it is all good advice. You know, patch your shit, don't run as admin, and then, you know, sticking software restriction policies, you know, whitelisting so far up the list, I think is a really good choice. I mean, it does depend on a bunch of other things that are further down the list, but I mean, no, I think it is a very good list and a good read for anybody, you know, who is responsible for security in their organization, which hopefully is most people listening to Risky Biz. It's kind of sad, though, in a way, that this is award-winning work. Like, the fact that this is recognized as being groundbreaking.
For
awesome,
not acting like a pack of boneheads, we dub the information security wizards.
Yeah, I mean, really, you know, patch your shit, don't run as admin,
and white
is the advice
stuff.
That's
yeah.
award-winning. Yeah, I mean... And we've been saying that for like the last 10 years.
Yeah, no, I know. But I do remember when DSD put out advice basically saying that whitelisting was like number 4 on the list of stuff that you should do. I think they might have even put it ahead of AV, which I thought was kind of interesting. And of course, DSD maintains the ACSI 33 standard. There is which is now the Information Security Manual. There is an unclassified section of it that you might find good reading.
Yeah, I would certainly endorse it. It's a very good read.
Now, a bit of light reading for the weekend. Now, our final story for the week, Adam. This is an interesting bit of research. I mean, it's not groundbreaking stuff, really, but it's just sort of proving something that I guess we've all thought. These guys can basically ID Skype users who are also sharing files. So you can actually grab a Skype user's IP and then look at what they're sharing on peer-to-peer networks, which is kind of an interesting little privacy glitch, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's good lateral thinking, this. I like it. Hey, it's the research, the individual bits of research, which is one, some information leaks out of Skype, and then two, correlating the results of communicating directly with a client using information you got via Skype to then identify whether or not a BitTorrent client is also running on the same system. You're looking at sequence numbers and all that sort of thing. It's very cool research. I'm not quite clear from reading the article exactly what bits are Skype's fault. There appear to be a number of issues which relate to being able to, you know, extract information from the communication via the Skype peer-to-peer network of traffic going through Skype supernodes to identify via, I gather, basically straight-up traffic analysis, what the real IP of a particular Skype user is. And they've done this without actually having to crack the Skype crypto, which is what makes me believe it's probably more related to traffic analysis. Mm. But anyway, it's very interesting research. And having come out of the academic environment, that's also pretty cool. And then, you know, correlating that with BitTorrent is, you know, I think quite a clever idea. Whether or not the companies that are commercially involved in tracking BitTorrent usage are doing stuff like this, I'm not sure. If they are, I guess it probably could be quite effective. But yeah, cool. Good work.
Yes, interesting academic research there, which it's actually worth having a look at. It's just general cleverness. And Adam, that actually brings us to the end of the week's news headlines, mate. Thank you so much for joining us. And of course, we're going to chat to you again next week, which will be the pre-KiwiCon show.
Yeah, it's certainly a busy week for me. And we'll try and cram it all in and talk to you then, Pat.
He's going to try to talk to us. Okay, mate. Thank you.
Cheers. See you, dude.
Adam Wylow there with a look at the week's news headlines. Before we get into this week's feature, I've got some jobs going that I'm trying to fill. I'm looking to recruit penetration testers with an interest in vulnerability research into a very interesting company that is looking to hire in Canberra, Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, and Perth. It is not one of the incumbent pen testing firms or Big Fours. It's a very interesting small company, which is stacked to the rafters with good people, good technical people. So if you want to know more about this, you can email me, Patrick, P-A-T-R-I-C-K, at risky.biz. Moving on, and up next, it's time for this week's feature interview with our good buddy, Patrick Webster. Pat is a pen tester and researcher based in Sydney, But he's also been involved in a bunch of global projects. He was a prolific Metasploit contributor, and he's also been involved in stuff like OSVDB, which is the Open Source Vulnerability Database Project. If you've been listening to the show lately, you would have heard about what happened to Pat. One evening, he was checking his superannuation account. For listeners based outside of Australia, we have a compulsory pension scheme in Australia, government-mandated pension scheme, and we call it superannuation. So basically, 9% of your wage goes into one of these pension funds. So yeah, he was checking his superannuation statement and noticed what looked suspiciously like a direct object reference in his browser URL bar. So he changed a number in the URL and up popped someone else's statement, and that is pretty bad. So he then wrote a little bash script that he ran for 5 minutes while he made a cup of tea. He's a tea drinker. And it downloaded around 500 statements of other members. He stopped the script, went to bed, and then the next morning spent some considerable time tracking down the right person at the pension fund to report the issue to. The fund, First State Superannuation, has around 770,000 members, who mostly work for the New South Wales state government, so police, nurses. Pat used to actually work for the New South Wales police, which is why he was with First State in the first place. So those sort of people. Now, First State's systems were administered by a company named Pillar Administration. Pillar handles multiple funds for a total membership base of 2 million members. That's around 10% of Australia's population. And of course, the bug affected all of these other funds as well. So Pat reported the bug. They said thanks. Then a few weeks later, the police showed up on his door and making some noises about him being charged with downloading files. And a large commercial law firm sent him a letter threatening to sue him unless he admitted he'd gained unauthorized access to member statements and agreed to turn over his computer for forensic analysis to make sure the member information he downloaded had been deleted. Now, this, believe it or not, is where the fun started. The issue hit the press, first by way of a story that ran here on risky.biz, and then it escalated from there, and it wound up a series of articles, wound up running on smh.com.au, written by Asher Moses, who I have to say did a really bang-up job of following up this piece. Now, First State now, because it basically rang the police on Pat, First State is now being investigated by the Federal Privacy Commissioner for failing to notify all members that their information had been so at risk for so many years. And even former staff of Pillar Administration have come forward claiming the flaw had been known about for years. If that wasn't enough, Pillar Administration was actually due to start handling superannuation for federal politicians, ASIO staff. ASIO is like Australia's CIA, department heads and other federal public servants. That was a $23 million contract that I believe is, you know, perhaps a little bit at risk. Apparently, the federal government has been in daily contact with Pillar over a period of weeks and demanded immediate remedial security work to their systems. So in other words, dobbing Pat into the police turned a minor incident into an extremely damaging event, both for Pillar and First State Superannuation. So, now that the dust has settled, I thought it would make sense to get Pat on the line and talk about the experience from his point of view. I started off by asking him how he reacted when the police turned up on his door.
I was surprised, mostly. When they arrived, I didn't know what they were actually here for. And they said it was downloading files, and I thought, geez, what files have I downloaded? But then they mentioned that it was First State Super, so, you know, I couldn't.
So you thought they were onto you about all of your donkey porn collection via BitTorrent?
That's right, yeah. All those websites.
What was their general attitude? I mean, were they quite polite, or did they even know really why they were there?
Well, they had to look at their notes to express what they were actually there for. They weren't overly aggressive, or they were just pass a message along, basically. They said that they'd received a report from First State Super that some files were downloaded, and they basically said that they're not going to press charges at the moment. They said that might change, but that's effectively the message that they're passing along. And then they said that if there's any further questions, to call another detective from the city, from the Rocks.
But did you wind up speaking to the detective at all?
No, actually, they didn't indicate that I actually needed to speak to the detective, so I thought I'd just leave it alone.
And then it was the very next day that you got a rather threatening letter from the commercial law firm Minters Ellison.
Well, it was interesting because I was speaking to a number of other security consultants, and everyone was suggesting or hinting that a letter like that would appear, and obviously it did arrive the next morning. It was concerning. Obviously, when I received that, I realised that obviously it was more serious than than what I thought it was. Obviously, that was a serious matter, but I was surprised, considering I was a member and I contacted them, and it was my information as well. And you know, generally, when security vulnerabilities are reported, as you mentioned, to other firms such as Google, the way that they handle the matter is very different.
Now, do you think that there should be some sort of standard guideline for how companies react to these sorts of situations? Because, I mean, we had many years ago, you remember we had the RF policy, which Rainforest Puppy put together, which was a rough set of guidelines for vendors in dealing with bug reports. I mean, do you think we need something equivalent for enterprises when we're dealing with web apps?
There certainly needs to be some standards to deal with this matter. Because I'm not the first and I'm not going to be the last. I suppose the problem is that when we're talking about corporations and governments, there's you know, tens of thousands or millions of these businesses, you know, run by different people. Especially in Australia, the majority of businesses are actually smaller in size rather than large corporations. So it would be actually hard to implement. I actually had a pet project, which was to create a website, not exactly to deal with this matter, but basically to handle notification of incidents like this and essentially be the broker and notifying the company and assisting with the resolution.
When did you come up with that idea?
That was a couple of years ago. It's actually on one of my to-do lists.
Bet you wish you finished it now, huh?
Yes, I do. It would have helped at the time, but then I would have been dealing with it myself. What to do? But I think that the government should consider setting aside some funding for a system like this. But I guess, you know, as a member of the fund, I felt it best to approach him personally. And the fact of the matter is it's my information and it's a personal matter and it affects a large number of people. So I just thought I'd deal with it privately and with, you know, without getting external parties involved because it might have been a little bit embarrassing. So I thought, you know, we should just keep it under wraps.
So you were trying to actually help them save face?
I was. Obviously, things have skewed at proportion, but at the time, yes.
Yeah, no, it is interesting, isn't it? Because things certainly have steered away from that direction. I mean, they've copped an absolute shellacking in the Sydney Morning Herald. I think the latest revelation from Asher Moses, who's been working the story over there at Fairfax, was that, you know, I think they were about to take over handling superannuation for people who worked for ASIO, the spy agency. So they've been getting a daily what the from the federal government. They've been investigated by the Federal Privacy Commissioner, the New South Wales Privacy Commissioner. There's a $23 million contract under review. Three people from Pillar, which is the superannuation administration arm of, or it was the superannuation administration firm that caused the blunder. Three people from there have offered their resignations. And the federal government has actually ordered immediate remedial security works on that site. On that system, I mean, talk about a backfire. I mean, have you been surprised by the extent to which this has bitten them on the ass?
When I first found the fault, especially considering my background at police, I was aware of what information was held by the fund, because you know I've worked with covert police and you know anti-terrorism and the justice sector, so corrections and magistrates. So when I first came across the issue, I did recognise that it was a critical issue which needed to be addressed, and it's quite serious. I mean, the media's spoken about identity theft and fraud, but it could also be used in other matters. I mean, if certain criminal groups were to get hold of the list, the outcome could be quite different, and it included my information as well. Fortunately, this has occurred before ASIO and the federal politicians have been added to the list because obviously there's people that have come out in the media and they've said that they've noticed it in the past as well, and certain staff which are effectively whistleblowers that are saying that they knew about it and whatnot.
So I guess what you're saying is you're not surprised by the extent of the backlash?
Not exactly. I mean, it was a very serious matter and that's why obviously I had to report it, because when I came across it, there was a few colourful words that I said to myself, and I thought, you know, I can't just leave this, because we see things like this all the time in the industry. You know, it happens on a daily basis almost anyway, but just because of the nature of the information, I knew that, you know, something had to be done. I couldn't just ignore it.
Now, you did mention that this sort of stuff is, you know, this sort of flaw, which was a, you know, direct object reference bug, which is, you know, real boneheaded OWASP top 10 stuff. You do see stuff like that all the time. There's been, you know, the public reaction to this has been one of outrage against First State Superannuation for actually, you know, dropping a dime on you and then threatening you with a civil lawsuit. It strikes me that, you know, if people are this outraged about one organisation with such a boneheaded flaw in it, I mean, they'd really do their block if they realised how prevalent these basic bugs are. I mean, do you agree with it?
I do agree, yes. I think, you know, as people have mentioned, it's this whole First State Super and Pillar matter has opened up a can of worms. You know, people are questioning whether changing a digit is you know, hacking or cracking or, you know, a breach of security.
Changing a digit in a URL.
Yeah, that's right. You know, people are looking at, you know, how corporations should respond to privacy breaches, whether it's malicious or in my circumstance being, you know, a member and notifying them. You know, how corporations react to this and whether they notify members.
Yeah, because there was a bit of an interesting debate there because they weren't sure whether they had to notify all members that their information was potentially exposed by that bug. I mean, it's been an interesting debate, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, and I'm not entirely sure of what the answer is, but hopefully this matter will set some kind of precedent, preferably without going through the legal system on my part, but hopefully in the future it'll establish some sort of clarification and procedure on how to handle these matters in the future. And as you've mentioned, because since this matter's in the public, you know, people have Googled my name and found my email address, whatnot, and I've received emails from people in Australia who have gone into their super, the independent super unrelated to First State, you know, other organisations or their bank accounts, and they've started incrementing numbers as well, which I won't necessarily endorse, but, you know, it's raised a bunch of questions, but people have done that, and some people have said that, a number of people have said that they've changed a number and they've received, you know, an access denied or an error message, which is what I thought I'd actually receive. But other people have come forward and said I've done it and they've found other people's information as well. So,
oh, Lord. So you've basically turned everyone who's been reading about this into an amateur pen tester looking for an OWASP top 10.
That's correct. Yeah, I think they might have to write a few IDS signatures just to look at people incrementing numbers because, yeah, it is occurring, and a number of people on different web media websites have said that they've changed a number. Oh. Obviously, some people have notified the companies involved, and hopefully it won't have the same sort of media impact, but I think it can only be beneficial that if people are doing these things and the issues are addressed, then hopefully they won't repeat the same mistake.
Now, I'd think that if I was running a competing superannuation fund, by this point I would have called in a bunch of pen testers. Would you think that there would be, just given the high-profile nature of this whole saga, you would think that there would be some increased interest in security from executives, given how bad First State looked out of all of this?
I think so, yes. I was thinking, actually, when it hit the media, that I wouldn't be surprised if, just for, you know, responsibility purposes, that every superannuation fund would be reviewing the security and speaking to the security team, or potentially creating more positions just to be sure, to save face, I suppose. But I wouldn't surprise me at all if they were.
Now, I understand you haven't had time to meet with the chief executive of First State Super, Michael Dwyer, yet, but they have extended an invitation for you to come and have a chinwag.
Yeah, so he did contact me and offer to meet one-on-one privately for 15 minutes. It was just bad timing because a number of other personal matters which require significant attention have cropped up at the same time. Plus, I have a bit of a cold. But I responded to him yesterday because I saw that there was something in another media outlet that was saying that I was too busy, which it is true. But I have spoken to a number of different solicitors. I just have to be careful, obviously, because of the sensitive nature of the matter. You know, IT... solicitors, criminal solicitors and commercial solicitors have all said don't meet with Michael Dwyer. I mean, I'm happy to assist as best I can, but considering the fact that the police are involved and Minter Ellison is involved, it would have been different, you know, if he said let's meet on one-on-one initially, but now that it's a legal matter, basically I have to take the solicitor's advice and that's what I've responded with, so I suppose I'll wait for him to get back to me.
So you've basically said, look, on legal advice, I'm just going to say no.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as I've said, I would like to assist with the matter and get it over and done with so that I can get back to business and they can as well. But it's just, accepting the legal advice I've probably spoken to a dozen, and other people come forward. You know, Electronic Frontiers Australia has come forward as well. And the 100% of the advice is not to attend the meeting, which I don't actually know what he would like to discuss. So I've asked for clarification on that. But at this stage, that's the advice.
So you're like, I want to be helpful, but you guys reported me to the police, and you know the whole lawsuit thing, kind of like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, ideally, this would have happened to begin with, instead of going to police and getting you know, mental health and involved. If you know, because I said, you know, if you've got any questions, please get in contact, which obviously didn't happen. At the time, I would have been happy to meet with him and say, you know, answer any questions that I had.
So let me ask you this, Pat. Next time you find a bug in online service, what are you going to do?
Good question. I think I'll have to consider what the nature of the vulnerability is or what sort of information is exposed. But since this matter, obviously I've established a number of relationships with IT solicitors and criminal solicitors and whatnot. So I think I'll be at least asking for advice before I consider disclosing it. You know, it might be best just to walk away and ignore it, but it depends on what the vulnerability exposes.
So if it was something of this nature, though, I mean, would you have done it all again?
I might have to toss a coin, leave it to a bit of luck, or let our chance decide.
Let fate decide, huh?
That might be the best way, but you know, morally and ethically, you know, it's something that couldn't be left to sit there, and especially, you know, it's my information, and I know that, you know, covert police and you know, anti-terrorism and law enforcement, you know, everyone was involved.
They were all members of that fund, you mean? Or?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, two million people, because I know that, you know, people say it was just First Aid Super, but obviously the vulnerability was in the on a pillar.com.au service.
And they're the administrator for a bunch of funds with two million members.
Right. Yeah, and you know, you could tell just from the type of issue that the interface that exposed that was a First Aid Super interface, but it was quite obvious, you know, because we see it all the time that the vulnerability or the same source code is probably used across the other funds.
All right, well, Pat Webster, thank you so much for taking some time. I know you're too busy to meet Michael Dwyer. I'm glad you're not too busy to meet us, mate, and I'm sure we'll speak to you again sometime soon, and we'll see you at RuxCon.
Thanks, Patrick.
Patrick Webster there with a look at the First State superannuation fiasco. Funny how things turn out sometimes. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now, and this week's show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security. And we are lucky to be able to chat to Tenable's chief executive, Ron Gula, on a fairly regular basis. Tenable has grown over the years and these days has around 150 staff, so we really are very happy that Ron actually makes the time to chat to us because, you know, being CEO of a company with 150 staff tends to keep you busy. And this week's topic, this week's sponsor interview, is a very interesting one. You may have heard last week we mentioned in the news that the United States regulator of publicly listed corporations, the Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC, it's issued some guidance to the market in terms of what it considers to be worthy of disclosure in companies' quarterly reports to the SEC. Now, this is in terms of cybersecurity and cyber incidents. So if you Google for CF Disclosure Guidelines Cybersecurity, one word, you'll find the relevant SEC edict. It's not so much a set of new rules, it's more an expression of how the SEC's Department of Finance views companies' existing legislative obligations when it comes to cybersecurity and incident disclosure. But it's rare to get this sort of guidance from a big bureaucracy, so it is very interesting. Now, it's quite a nuanced document, but basically it says companies have to disclose material cyber risks and events. So we're going to chat now with Ron Gula about what that means. He joined me to discuss the SEC statement and what it all means. Here's what he had to say.
So normally I'm not a fan of more regulation, but in this case, I think it's the SEC kind of catching up with the modern era. Any company that's going public is going to potentially have some sort of cyber risk they have to disclose. It could be a power company with, you know, smart grid vulnerabilities. It could be somebody like Netflix having to disclose that, you know, a majority of what they use to serve content to their customers is dependent upon a third party such as Amazon. So, you know, being able to disclose cybersecurity risks or potential security risks might be small potatoes in the grand scheme of things.
Well, what I find interesting about this is it's not actually new regulation. What the SEC seems to have done here is more or less issue a clarifying memorandum, basically saying, here is what we believe your responsibilities under existing legislation is. I mean, it seems a pretty smart, light touch way to go about things, doesn't it?
It does. And part of the reason I'm kind of familiar with companies filing these S-1s is whatnot. People shouldn't read into anything that we're planning for Tenable anytime soon. But having said that, you know, when a company goes public, they really transform themselves from being a very privately, inwardly focused company to being very transparent, being very careful about what they say, not to overpromise or to underpromise. To say anything incorrectly, whether it's overdoing what you're doing or underdoing what you're doing, is really a problem, including risk. So any type of clarification is usually a good thing.
Do you think that companies have been as forthcoming when it comes to these sorts of risks as they should have been? I mean, why do you think that the SEC has found it necessary to issue this clarification?
Oh, they were probably asked. I mean, there's a lot of times you are in meetings, you are talking to auditors, you are talking to people you've contracted with to give them their advice, and it's not necessarily black and white. You know, sometimes you have the problem of, gee, we want to do the right thing, but maybe disclosing too much is actually the wrong thing. So sometimes it's very difficult to figure out, you know, what's the right level of information to give out to potential shareholders, and at the same time trying to balance any type of competitive edge before you go public.
Yeah. Now, I'm wondering what this is going to mean also for organizations that have previously been sort of sweeping stuff under the carpet. Now that it's been explicitly laid out that that there is an obligation to disclose incidents and risks, would you expect that we're going to start seeing more in SEC filings?
I think once you go public, you are so much in the public eye. What the SEC may or may not do to you might be irrelevant. Like, I mean, look at what Netflix is doing, going through right now here in the States. I apologize to the Australian listeners if they're not following the news, but Netflix issued 3 or 4 major announcements, and they've actually had a lot of loss of customers and whatnot. And that has nothing to do with, you know, cybersecurity and whatnot. It has everything to do with once you're public, your image and your brand name is really what people are buying.
With that said, though, do you think that there's been an appropriate level of disclosure in SEC filings to date? Or do you think that we're going to actually start seeing more detail on this? I mean, do you think this announcement, this edict, this memo, whatever you want to call it, from the SEC is actually going to have any sort of material impact on the types of disclosures that we're seeing in statements?
Yeah, I don't think you're going to be able to pour through SEC statements and find undisclosed hacker or insider theft, you know, incidents of material value, right? You know, if Coca-Cola was going public and a hacker came in and stole their secret formula, you know, I don't know if you're going to hear about that in an S1 filing. It really depends on the business. It really depends on what they do. You know, companies like Exxon, companies like NASDAQ, they're getting attacked all the time. It's part of business, being able to respond to attacks, whether they're from malicious insiders, from cyber attackers, from APT. You know, if you're building a business and you're getting ready to go public and you're not taking care of those things, you know, you're probably not going to be able to amass the size of company you need to go public in the first place. So I don't think we're going to see a flood of disclosures now all of a sudden.
But, I mean, these rules apply to not just companies that are going public, but companies that are already public. And I would have thought that the theft of Coca-Cola's secret formula is exactly the sort of thing they're saying should wind up in filings, no?
You know, you're probably right. And I think one of the bad things with analogies is there's never the perfect analogy, right? So if you look at companies that are recently, that have recently gone public, you know, in the security industries where I'm most, you know, most familiar with, there aren't that many of them. And if you go back and you read those S1 filings and you start looking at that and you say, hey, what kind of information is really driving this company? What kind of risks do they really put out there? They put some really obscure things in those S1 things. And it really, they're more worried about things like the economy, market things, channel risk, a lot of stuff that they can't really control, let alone, you know, some hacker, you know, breaking in and stealing their sales list. That's not as big of a risk as I think people realize when it comes to running a business.
So you think that perhaps a lot of these
clarification's a good thing.
So you think perhaps a lot of these risks that we get in a flap about in the information security industry, perhaps in the grand scheme of things to a listed company, aren't necessarily, you know, terribly disclosure worthy.
No, I mean, and if you look, there's some high profile cases out there, right? So you got Sony, you got RSA. Everybody knows they've been in the news. Google's been in the news for getting attacked. There will probably be more. But if you go back and you look at those companies, their stock's doing quite well. I mean, for years, people have been pointing out that the DataLossDB project, when companies have losses, it doesn't really seem to affect their stock price, their shareholder value. There's lots and lots of other factors that that can do that. It's more like the smaller companies. I forget the SSL certificate company that's gone out of business.
DigiNotar was the one, the Dutch one, yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. I think that's less of the norm. That's definitely an exception to the rule. I don't believe that every company that has a cyber attack is going to go out of business. But every company probably should expect to have a cyber attack and deal with it.
That's interesting, actually, because now that you pointed out, you're actually making an extremely valid point, which is that even under the most disastrous circumstances, I think the PlayStation Network, they lost some customers, but now they're growing. I mean, I'm a PlayStation customer. I'm on the PlayStation Network. I didn't run out and buy an Xbox. So I guess to that degree, maybe we do tend to shout the sky is falling, at least from a public disclosure standpoint.
I mean, absolutely. Security is very, very important, right? Is it as important as realizing that, you know, Sony and Microsoft have completely different strategies when it comes to the video game industry, and that's really what you should be, you know, basing your investment strategy on when you go to companies like that? That's kind of the point. So I think to have this type of clarification from the SEC is a good thing for investors so they can kind of understand the risks in these businesses and also the opportunities of, you know, new technologies such as, you know, the green technologies, cloud, you know, doing things virtually, outsourcing and whatnot. But, you know, trying to comb these S1s for evidence of, you know, new APT attacks and stuff like that, I don't think that's where we're going to see those things.
That's a very interesting take. Now, Ron, I also believe that you have some news coming out of Tenable. You guys are actually launching a pilot within the U.S. Department of Defense. Is that correct?
Absolutely. We were selected to be the pilot for something called ACAST, which is basically a enterprise-wide vulnerability and passive network monitoring solution for the entire United States Department of Defense. We're in pilot phase right now, and we're very excited. It's a good responsibility, and it's very interesting working at the scale of the entire DoD. You're talking about scanning, you know, millions, if not multiple millions of IP addresses and rolling all this up. Very, very interesting times.
Now, I believe you actually spent some time at the NSA many, many years ago, so this must feel like a hell of a win for you.
It's, you know, being an American citizen, you know, having worked in the NSA, I was in the Air Force, the United States Air Force for a good bit. It's a very big win. It's a big responsibility, too, and I think we're up to it.
All righty. Well, Ron Gula, thank you so much for joining us on the show, and we'll chat to you again in about 4 weeks.
And I hope everybody in Australia enjoys spring as we start going into the fall season here in the States.
Drink in your hand, wash the blood off thirst. Madness imitates the passion, gifts can be a curse. Don't think too soon, make your...
Tenable Network Security's Chief Executive Ron Gula on the line from the USA there with a look at a recent guidance from the SEC regarding cybersecurity incidents. And that's it for this week's show. This week's track is another one by Lloyd Spiegel, our good friend Lloyd. And this one is called For the Kill. You can find it on iTunes. Until next week, I have been Patrick Gray. Thank you for listening.
I ain't got no time to bleed, just stitch me up with sin. I'm bound to leave a nasty scar right below the skin. I'm as angry as a broken, drunk as I am ill. Dangerous and on the edge and ready for the kill. Now patience is expensive, compassion's got a price. A gambler don't respect the man who handed him the dice. Get yourself together, boy, now you ain't dying yet. This gambler's putting bets on you. Until you put that woman down, let her crawl back where she came and get up off the